Now, you suggested a minute ago that you feared that if the front had any real influence in Iran, that it could lead to a weakening of the country. What was the basis of your apprehension?
Apprehension is based really on the possible increase in Soviet influence within the within the country. It would weaken the links with the United States.
Oh, because they're the neutral posture,
yes,
they would have taken
exactly. Exactly. If we wish to use Iran as an ally in that area, I think we can be useful.
Now, were your officers continuing their contacts with the front during the Kennedy years?
Yes.
Yeah.
But that was kept up continuously. Whether the Shah liked it or not.
He still continued to make
complaints
about this?
Got uneasy about it all the time.
But you had the ambassador support in this question, on this issue, so you could continue. Now, in early May of 61, protests by teachers led to a major demonstration in Tehran, which was suppressed by the police, army companies, I guess, and a special force parachute battalion, from what I've read, which led to the death of one teacher. Now, according to one cable message that I've seen, people in the Royal Palace were very worried about this turn of events and the possibility that the military might break ranks over this issue. Do you recall anything about the strikes, about these strikes,
yes,
and the Shah's reaction to these developments?
I remember that there was a tense situation, and we were trying to keep track of what was going on by having people, like observers on the scene and that kind of thing. I think that the Shah's reaction was that the only thing to do was to put this down by force. I don't think there's anything more profound than that.
Now, in the wake of the teacher strike and the suppression of the demonstrations, the Shah dissolved parliament, dismissed Sheriff Amini as prime minister, and appointed Ali Amini as his successor.
Yes. Who was supposed to have more appeal to the National Front and that kind of thing.
Now, apparently, in the years that followed, many Iranians have felt that that Amini had been the U.S.'s favorite candidate for this post.
Yes.
And some years later, Armin Meyer, who had been ambassador, and was a member of the task force in Iran that was meeting in Washington around this time, that Meyer suggested that there was something to that. That the U.S. extended $33 million in aid in return for certain changes, such as the appointment of a reformist prime minister. To what extent is Meyer's recollection on target that there was some U.S. encouragement and financial support for such a change?
I think he is right on target.
How would you describe the U.S. role in the decision of the Shah to appoint Amini?
It was made clear to him that that would be considered a very wise appointment. And I think that was it. It wasn't forcefully suggested to him.
Tactfully suggested.
Suggested.
Was it by name?
We always thought that Amini was our man for some reason. I personally think that Amini was a thorough success, but personally don't. The government was a very effective politician for his standard age, but he was obviously highly thought of in Washington.
I think partly because of his roles in the negotiations, the consortium agreement back in 53.
That was it.
And he was ambassador for a while, too?
Yes, he was. He was ambassador in Washington. That's when I met him personally in Washington.
Now, back to this question of Amini's appointment, was he suggested by name, or just was it, that it was
no,
good
no.
to find a by name? Was this Wales? Or you, or both, or both
not
of you.
Me.
Yeah. So we've been the ambassador.
Yes.
We've been the ambassador.
Yeah.
Making the suggestions. Now, according to the accounts that I've seen, the Shah, in fact, feared Amini. Did he tell you what he thought about his prime minister? Did he discuss this question with you of his apprehensions and fears about Amini?
I think he feared that, that Amini might have strong links with the, well, might develop, come under the influence of the National Front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you think that had much cause, that argument had much, that fear had much of a basis to it, or?
I think it had some basis to it, yes.
Well, I read earlier that that Amini had more of closer ties with conservative generals and conservative people in Tehran than he did with the National Front or reformers.
Of course, he came from such a prominent family that he had close ties with anybody who's prominent and important.
Uh-huh.
But I think he belonged to the sort of, he was more inclined toward the Western educated type intellectuals who formed the real base for the National Front.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You got to know him fairly well?
Oh, yes.
Yes. You met with him from time to time? Or?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. He was afraid that Bakhtiar was going to stage a coup.
That's right, so some of the reports that I've seen suggested that in Washington, at least, some of the CIA people were apprehensive that the military might move against Amini.
Right.
In May 61,
yes.
Around that time. Was there discussion of this in Tehran?
Yeah.
Of this possibility?
Mm-hmm.
Was a concern based upon something that was...
I don't think that there were any very serious indications of it, but there was concern that something might happen.
The military was there some corps of the military that were restive?
I think not very happy about it.
Were any preventive measures taken to forestall any developments that might move toward, that might lead towards a coup, or was the situation?
I think it was just a matter that there was extra vigilance at the time.
So your officers kept their ears open, basically, to see
no specific measures were taken to block
it. Now, according to one CIA report from the period, Amini and the people around him wanted to find ways to circumscribe the Shah's power. To what extent did the Kennedy administration and the State Department share in that purpose, trying to find ways to put limits on the Shah's power?
I think that actually took place, and I think that Bobby Kennedy was one of the figures in Washington who sort of was promoting that line of the state.
To what extent was the embassy, Ambassador Wales, supportive of that purpose?
I would say he was not supportive of that.
Now, around the time that Amini became Prime Minister, the Shah fired Savaki Bakhtiar,
yes,
replacing him with General Pakravan.
Right.
And what did you learn about the reasons for this change? I think you alluded to them earlier, the Shah's fears about Bakhtiar.
I think the Shah, at that time, the Shah canned the chief of the Supreme Staff, General Petraeus, the chief, the J2 of the armed forces, that is the chief of intelligence for the Supreme Staff, Hajar Kia, the head of the National Police, General Mogadam, General Mogadam, Mogadam, I guess, and General Bakhtiar.
The wholesale purge.
wholesale prayers at the top level, of which all but Bhaktiar were put in prison, and Bhaktiar was asked to leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
Bhaktiar came to me immediately after he got this instruction from the Shah. He was at the call, he just had an instruction to leave Iran, and he was given, I think, 24 hours, which later extended to 48 hours. Or minor for the Federation. He felt that, he felt very bitter about it, he felt that this was really a total failure to recognize his past services and to recognize his loyalty. What anyone could do, it's not the place of the United States to interfere, things like that. So then the real return against the Shah. He already questioned some of the Shah's policies before that.
Well, for example, did he recall some of his concerns?
He felt that the Shah had isolated himself from the country. He felt that the Shah's entourage were a group of people who are only helping to drag the Shah down and rather than help him administer the country in a rational way. And he also was opposed to corruption, although I have the impression that he had his share too. It was a standard way, I think, of rewarding people in top positions, a system dating back to the time of Cyrus and Darius and so on, I'm sure, traditional. But in any case, he became very very bitter, and then he started to work against the Shah more.
Did you stay in touch with Bhaktiar after he left the country? Did you have any contact with him after he left?
I did, yeah.
Uh-huh. Just for personal contact? Or?
Personal contact.
Uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Switzerland, France.
Uh-huh. Did he talk, did he discuss with you his activities?
Mm-hmm.
Did the Shah explain to you his purposes of making this wholesale approach of the top leadership of the military? Did he, go on to this question?
Yes, and it was, I think generally he felt that they had all become such rivals of each other,
mm-hmm.
that the efficiency of the whole system was somewhat endangered as a result. And it was the only way to clean things up was to start afresh.
Mm-hmm.
And all the replacements were weaker people after this. So he was really very much concerned about their ability to act against them if they found it desirable to do so.
So his purpose was political in nature?
Yes.
Now, would General Pakraban be in that same category as somewhat?
No, Pakraban was a much weaker personality, and Pakraban was an intellectual, really sort of academically inclined, academically inclined, analyst of intelligence and in the sort of serious sense of mm-hmm. providing serious intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
He was a much much less forceful man than any of the others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think he found it very hard to carry out some of the functions that set up as obliged to carry out.
In terms of internal policing and
yes.
repression, whatever.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Now, according to a report from 1962, prepared by the agency in Washington, Pakraban was loyal to the Shah, but there were some doubts about lower level Sadok officers, Prince of the Royalty.
Yes.
How serious a problem was that considered?
I don't remember that it was considered a serious problem. I think it was recognized that Sadok actually managed to have assigned to it some very superior and quite intellectual officers, and among them were people who recognized the weaknesses of Bashar's conduct, his line of action. So there was, I don't think that any of them were certainly at that time at the stage where they would have plotted against the Shah.
Now, at the same time that Amini's made prime minister, this military purge is occurring, the embassy's reporting about what Ambassador Wales called, in quotes, growing sentiment among influential Iranians in favor of a neutral policy for Iran and withdrawal from CENTO. Did you have any conversations with Iranians? Did any of your contacts among in the Iranian community discuss these ideas with you, or
No. And I don't think they would have raised that question of that with me, but certainly with my management staff.
Did you share this concern with the ambassador that this about his current opinion in favor of a neutral posture?
Oh yeah,
we raised this before, but it was something that comes up again and again. I guess.
Yes, it comes up again and again. It's a sort of constant matter there. I think that kind of thing is really part of the Iranian national character.
In terms of, can you elaborate upon that?
In terms of positioning themselves, well, they're very opportunistic people, and they would like the maximum amount of flexibility to profit from all directions. And I think that there is some feeling that neutral stand would eliminate some of the pressures from the Soviet Union, and I guess that's about it.
And perhaps give Iran more control over its oil revenues as well. Is that
an
issue?
Oh yes.
To what extent did the embassy, or you and your office?
But it would have been hard to try any harder to get control of the oil revenues than the Shah traffic. That was always a major objective of things, too.
To increase his power over the consortium.
Over the consortium, yes.
Yeah.
And to increase the proportion of Iran's take from the oil.
Now, I know this is quite an issue in the later 60s, but how often did it come up during your stay in Iran?
During my stay, I stayed there, you see, until the end of nearly the end of 63.
Right,
so
right.
There was a lot of discussions about that, and I think the Shah took great pride in his first case involving the Italians, that he managed to get such a large proportion of the oil price for
something along those lines. But his position vis-a-vis the consortium was still fairly weak, at this stage.
That's right.
Now, in terms of this question of neutralism in Iran in early 61, to what extent did the embassy or you and your officers make any efforts to counter these sentiments among influential Iranians?
I just don't recall any great effort into that.
Yeah, this. Now, according to a report from the State Department's Iran desk, the Shah was still under pressure from the Soviet Union to move towards neutralism. And because he could make such a switch, this is a quote, "One of our ambassador's main tasks has been to dissuade him, to soothe him, and to reassure him of U.S. support." Did you provide any assistance to Ambassador Wales in his efforts to dissuade and soothe the Shah and,
oh, yes,
and U.S. support?
Yes, he did. Yeah. And this came up in the course of ordinary discussion quite often.
What kind of assurances could you make to him about American support?
Well, I don't think that one could, or one could do much more than to assure him that it is there, and it should be manifest to him from our actions that it's there.
In terms of military assistance and so forth.
Yes.
But again, he was not always persuaded by that, apparently.
No, he was not. Always hoping for more.
Now, in early May 61, soon after the teacher strike, President Kennedy appointed a special Annecy task force headed by Phillips Talbot of the State Department to study the situation in Iran and make recommendations as to policy changes. And I guess by mid-May, the task force had made a preliminary report but continued to meet in Washington for the spring and summer, winding up its activities, I think, in the fall of 61. Did you have any input into the task force work? Did you see their report, their papers over from time to time and make suggestions?
I did. And in fact, I think I attended one of their gatherings when I was back home. But the details are certainly vague in my mind.
So when you made periodic visits to Washington as station chief, and you consulted with responsible officials in the agency about Iran, State Department as well?
Yes.
You met with State Department?
Yes, State Department.
Was it mostly the people in INR or the desk officials as well? Or about a higher level?
Higher level.
Yeah. The Assistant Secretary?
Yes. Secretary and desk level.
That would have been Talbot, I guess,
Still Talbot.
And you just give them your appraisal of current developments.
Or answer specific questions.
Now, during the spring or early summer of 61, Julius Holmes replaced Edward Wales as U.S. ambassador. You mentioned Holmes a little bit earlier, but how had you met him before?
No.
Before he became ambassador?
I've met him before.
I think he had mostly European assignments up to that point, I think. Britain and elsewhere.
In
South Africa.
Cool.
How closely did you work with him? Like, was it
very close? We had a very good working relationship.
And how effective do you think he was? As ambassador?
I think he was a very effective ambassador. Probably more effective than his successor is. He was very effective.
What in particular made him stand out as an ambassador?
I think he was forceful in defending the embassy's positions against state. He was forceful in the handling of the execution of our policies in Iran, both within the framework of the embassy and the military mission, so that he really asserted his authority as the number one American commander in the area. I thought that was very, very well.
How would you describe his relationship with the Shah? What you could tell.
He seemed to have a good relationship with the Shah. He seemed to have a good relationship with the Shah, but I think he, I think he perhaps was not too happy with the fact that there was somebody there who knew the Shah much more intimately and in a more, much more personal way than he did. However, I think he made full use of the situation. This is off the record, so you might press your button there.
you were saying?
Well, I was saying that the day after he arrived, he summoned me to his office and told me that he was afraid that he would have to send me home. I asked him why, and he said that Iran just isn't big enough for both of us, as far as he can see from the situation which he discovered on arrival. Then I explained to him that I knew my place perfectly well, and that I thought this could be useful to him, and I would do everything I can to make myself available for his purposes during the remaining time of my tour. And this evolved into a very effective and happy working relationship and a close personal friendship.
So he really had been concerned about your close relationship with the Shah.
Yes.
That might interfere with his,
that's right,
with his job.
Yeah. And the fact that I knew all cabinet ministers, uh-huh, and the entire top level in the government, and circulated freely, mm-hmm, among them, on a social level, mm-hmm, and often in connection with work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Of course, Holmes is becoming ambassador at the stage where Amin's prime minister is trying to move on certain reform issues, but apparently with some difficulty, because apparently in August 61, President Kennedy expressed concern that Amini had not done enough to establish his own political base in the country. Why did Amini fail to develop a constituency? What was his difficulties? What difficulties did he encounter in this?
I don't really know. And don't really understand that. And he came from one of the top families, mm-hmm, so that his position among the top people in government was thoroughly established. But I think that he was considered perhaps a little bit too intellectual and liberal.
Well, perhaps Kennedy's concern was that he had not developed a constituency among the broad middle class, lower class, or the lower class elements of society.
Absolutely,
that might have been the issue.
Was, yeah, strictly upper class.
Yeah, yeah. Did the Prime Minister make much in the way of an effort to develop a relationship or an entente with the nationalist opposition?
Yes, I think he did.
Uh-huh. How successful was that from your...
And I think he was... he certainly had much closer contacts with them than the preceding prime ministers. And I think it was thought for a while that he would get a lot of their support.
But he didn't, or did, or...?
And I think for a while he did.
Yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh.
I think for a while he did.
I guess there were some mixed interpretations of that, because I see in one embassy report from this period that suggested that he tried to reach an understanding with the National Front, but failed. And because of that failure, or relative failure, he had to seek support or toleration from more conservative elements, like the military.
I just don't recall that detail.
Yeah, yeah.
He was always a little bit concerned about the military, and just after he was appointed, as I told you, he was afraid, yeah, of the fact that he was going to stage a coup. And I think that his cultivation of the military was just a normal step that he would take to strengthen his position.
Mm-hmm. What does your contacts at Savak think about Amini as Prime Minister?
I don't know if we ever discussed,
yeah,
discussed that. I don't think that That really was a matter that came up.
Now, according to an October 61 message from Phillips Talbot in Washington, the U.S. had strongly urged Khomeini to implement various social and economic reforms. Now, why did Washington think it was necessary to urge the Prime Minister to press for reforms? Because I think wasn't the understanding was that he would move on certain questions as Prime Minister, move on social reform issues. Wasn't that the assumption that was made when he took when he took his job?
It was, I think that things were moving very very slowly. I think that, and I don't know quite why that happened. Either he was too timid what the reason was, trying to ingratiate himself with the sharp hats for a moment in order to establish his position. He didn't push us into as hard as hoped he would.
But do you think he had a personal commitment to pushing for these reforms?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
So it might have been a question about a train to upset the Shah?
Yes, I think it would be more of a tactical matter.
Now, back to Talbot suggested the U.S. has to urge the Prime Minister to move on this, on these issues. Would Ambassador Holmes the one that have been the one who did the urging?
Yes. Yes, he would be.
Did you recall how much success he had with that meeting?
Don't recall. I don't have a specific reaction to it.
Okay.
I think that I came away with the conclusion that Khomeini was weaker than I actually originally thought.
Now, according to some of the cables that I've seen, it seems that by October 61, the Shah was giving some thought to removing Khomeini and ruling Iran directly without a strong prime minister. But that Holmes and the British ambassador, his name escapes me, that both of them discouraged him from moving along those lines. Did the Shah discuss this issue with you?
I don't recall.
Now, it sounds like Holmes had not really convinced the Shah, because according to a Richard Collins' recent book, when the Shah made a state visit to Washington in the spring of 62, he wanted to know whether Washington would object if he removed his prime minister. Do you recall if that's, if there's any truth to that, or does that evoke any recollection?
It does not, but I think that the Shah would have sort of tried to test Washington's reaction to that without asking for permission to remove him. He'd be very sensitive about anything that smacked of that. Just to see what the reaction would be if he were there. Because he felt that we had imposed Khomeini. I mean, he felt that very strongly. He was our man, we had, I mean, he's talked to me that way, hard. Our man, we imposed him.
Did you know when the Shah made his decision to dismiss Khomeini?
No.
Or finesse him out of the job? Now, according to a message that Holmes sent Washington, when the Shah made his visit to D.C. in spring 62, he was depressed and insecure. That's the quote, depressed and insecure.
Yes.
Do you remember much about that? About
yes. I don't remember much, but I remember that he was in a depressed frame of mind, and he always felt that we were not backing him with complete sincerity. But the details escaped him.
Now, when the Shah made his visit to Washington, he and President Kennedy agreed on a multi-year program of military assistance. I think it was sort of a five-year plan of military aid. Did this agreement touch upon your activities in Iran? For example, was there more funding for internal security-related programs, or was it purely a military?
Purely military.
Now, at the end of 61, Alan Dulles resigned after the Bay of Pigs.
Yes.
And John McCone took over as Director of Central Intelligence. Did McCone make any visits to Iran during his tenure as DCI?
I used to see him, but
yeah.
I don't remember his coming to Iran. I saw him in Washington a lot during my visits, but I don't remember his coming to Iran.
How interested was he in Iran?
Quite interested.
Yeah.
Yes, he was quite interested.
So he wanted to get with you so you could report on the latest development.
Right.
And of course, Richard Helms replaced Bissell as chief of the clandestine division at the same time. Did he travel to Iran at any point when you were in Tehran?
I think he came once.
How knowledgeable was he about the country?
He was quite knowledgeable. Because somebody who wasn't his full time interest. He was quite knowledgeable.
Now apparently, one incident that hurt Amini's credibility as prime minister, at least his credibility among liberal nationalists, was in January 1962, when military commandos attacked a student demonstration at Tehran University, which led to the university being closed down, I think, in 1962, for a while. Do you know if the Shah had consulted Amini before he approved action against the students?
I don't.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
Now, some months after the demonstrations at Tehran University, Douglas Marshall, who was with the consular section of the embassy, met with Dr. Bagai, who was one opposition figure at this time. And Bagai said that the recent riots resulting in the closing of the university were the results of manipulations of General Bakhtiar. And General Bakhtiar, he said, was encouraged and assisted in these activities by, this is a quote, by that colonel in the military attaché office at the American Embassy, the one with the Russian name. And then he went on to mention Colonel Yatsevich by name. And he suggested that that you had mentioned Bakhtiar, that was involved in some way in this in the recent riots at the university. Did these charges come to your attention or at this time?
As I recall it, they did, and of course that was obvious to everybody that that's absolute nonsense. But rumors like that are endemic in Iran. They feel that they're always being controlled by some outside power, and there's always somebody manipulating things behind the scenes.
The idea of the foreign hand.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I guess the assumption was that because you had some personal friendship with Bakhtiar, therefore you were involved.
I presume might have been the basis.
Now, some months later, in July 1962, Amini resigned, and the Shah began to implement his own reform program. Now, the incident that prompted Amini's resignation was a dispute with the Shah over the military budget, which he wanted to cut somewhat so he could reach a better fiscal position. Did the Prime Minister seek any U.S. financial support in order to resolve the dispute over the military budget? Did he try to get any American support so he could keep his position as Prime Minister or not?
I just don't recall.
Yeah.
I just don't know.
Yeah. That might have involved Holmes more than you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Although Amini could have talked about a matter like that with me, but I don't recall his ever having done so.
Now, when Amini resigned, the Shah appointed Asadullah Alam as Prime Minister. Did you know Alam personally?
I knew Alam extremely well.
How would you characterize him?
Alam comes from a ruling family in eastern Iran. He, I think, was a very wise and a very skillful manager. And he was probably almost the only person who could among the Iranians who could call a spade to the Shah's face. But he also was completely the Shah's servant. He had an excellent manner with all classes of people, and I think generally highly, highly regarded.
Did you think that the Shah's decision to appoint Alon had any special significance on its own?
I think the significance was that he decided that he's got to appoint somebody in whom he has complete trust. And Alon was one of the few people in the Shah trusted completely. And as he did General Fardoust, but in the latter case, that trust was high in his place.
So it seems, from recent revelation.
But those are two personalities who had really complete freedom from the Shah to express differing views from his.
Now, Ahmadi's Minister of Agriculture, Hassan
Arsenjani,
who was in charge of the land reform program, stayed in office for some months after Ahmadi's resignation. Did you meet Arsenjani? Did you know him?
Oh, yes.
What were your impressions of him?
Well, Arsenjani was a slightly leftish-leaning type with ambitious ideas about what he would do with the peasantry and so on. And I don't really think that he was a very serious person. He certainly didn't last very long. But he talked a good liberal game for quite a while.
I think I have a recollection that there was some concern, perhaps on the Shah's part, that he was moving too quickly on land reform.
There was concern on the Shah's part that he was pushing things too fast.
Do you think that would have accounted for his political demise, or
that and his sort of general leftist inclinations, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, in September 62, the Shah began what might be called a détente for the Soviet Union by announcing that Iran would not be the site of foreign missile bases.
Yes,
I think this is the first such announcement from a U.S. ally. Did this take you and Holmes by surprise, or were you informed in advance?
I don't think it took us by surprise. I think it was he was just leaning in that direction. What with the Soviet steel plant, steel mill, which I don't recall whether that took place before.
I think that was a few years later.
But he kept talking about the need for sort of establishing a less confrontational relationship with his neighbor, and often with a sort of implication that he's forced into this position because armed military aid isn't really quite enough yet.
Could this have been a move partly to appease the nationalists?
I think appease nationalists, yes. Uh-huh.
Did this cause much concern at the embassy, this decision? Was it what was your reaction to it? Brothers?
Concerned, no, but I think disquiet. Yes. Uh-huh. I think nothing serious is concerned, but uneasiness. Uh-huh. It seemed to be a totally unnecessary move at the time in view of the external pressures on him, so it could have been more of a soft to the domestic liberals.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Now, during the period after Ahmadi's resignation, Prime Minister Alon undertook negotiations with the National Front leadership. Did he discuss these negotiations with you?
Yes.
What was his purpose? Just trying to get an autonomy?
Broaden the base of support. Uh-huh. See if they could be won over. Uh-huh. And of course, I think it was a matter that was often suggested to him by us that it would be wise to broaden broaden the base. Yeah, we can win more support among the public.
Mm-hmm. Probably one of the issues during these negotiations was the fact that the front was requesting or asking for the holding of national elections, because Parliament had been disbanded for a couple of years.
Yes.
And I think they wanted to hold new elections.
Right.
The law would not accept that.
Yes.
Apparently in January 1953, the Shah had much of the front's leadership arrested, from what I've read. Do you know why the Shah finally decided to crack down against the National Front?
I think he was preparing a different type of political organization to represent the so-called opposition. That was when he created these two parties, the Mardon Party,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I think the other one was called Rastafiz, apparently.
That was later, but
that was
the mid-70s.
Tell us.
But the one was the Mardon Party, and the other was